or on land he used to own. This happens quite frequently in the New Testament. With a lot of the parables, you'll have a debtor or a tenant farmer working on land that he used to own. So this is reflected, this tendency is reflected in the biblical laws. Exodus 22 would be one of the more famous and early ones. This is one of the earliest laws in the Old Testament. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not extract interest from them. If you take your neighbor's cloak and pawn, you shall return it before the sun goes down. May be your neighbor's only cloak to use as cover. And what else shall the person sleep? That person sleep. The word for interest here, I've written it out, is neshek. And not only can it mean interest, but it also is the same word used for the bite of a serpent, which is interesting. And I find that to be fascinating. So the entire regulation reflects the tendency for the wealthy to manipulate the vulnerable classes through usury, especially when the social structure allows for such a behavior. And if you don't have other forms of collateral, lending arrangements could even, with superiors, could deprive someone of basic necessities, including their clothes. So note that this passage does not forbid usury in all circumstances. It's very clear that it was practiced. Interest-bearing loans seem to be acceptable among people of a certain means or with a merchant when you're engaging in financial transactions. It's unfair loans with vulnerable persons because they run contrary. Remember what we talked about last week, mighty king, lover of justice. You have established equity in the land. There's a sense in which, because God is a God of mishpat, Hebrew word for justice, that it is obligatory for human beings, those who are part of the covenant community, to extend the same hospitality and generosity with their fellow person. So you do get that in the earliest laws. This is a more detailed regulation. Don't take interest in advance or otherwise make a profit from them, the debtor, but fear God, let them live with you. You should not lend your money at interest taken in advance or provide them food at a profit. And this Leviticus 25, I'm not going to go into the whole chapter. Some of you will have read this or be familiar with it. This is what is known as the Jubilee year, in which you have different levels of indebtedness that can lead someone to lose his land and end up working as an indentured servant on land he used to own. The Jubilee year provides for the return of all lands to the original owner every 50 years. We're not entirely clear if this was ever actually practiced, but it certainly is in the Bible. And during the period of working off the loan, the borrower pays no interest until the creditor has received everything he's due. So, again, huge debates on whether this was actually practiced that I can go into if you would like. There's another passage in Deuteronomy, which is interesting. Don't take interest on loans to another Israelite, interest on money, interest on provision, interest on anything that is lent. It's important to remember that ancient Israelite society, the Judea of Jesus' day, there was coinage, especially during the Roman period, but it was still, there was a great deal of bartering that would take place. You would trade something for something else, oftentimes there was not currency involved. You could still charge interest, though. On loans to a foreigner, you may charge interest, but on loans to another Israelite, you may not charge interest, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all your undertakings in the land that you are about to enter in and possess. Note here that this is more strict than the one in Exodus. The one in Exodus says, don't take advantage of a poor person. Deuteronomy is a little bit later and says, fellow Israelites can't charge interest on each other at all. You can do it if you're engaging with an outsider, but you can't do it with a fellow Israelite. This would probably be more of an ideal or a hope than something that was actually practiced. It seems very clear that interest, the charging of interest, continued throughout the course of the history in which the Bible was written. The most famous passage in this regard is maybe one you haven't ever paid a ton of attention to, but it's one of the more interesting ones. And that's in Nehemiah 5, which describes a crisis based on interest. Nehemiah is a book that is written in the Persian period, what we refer to as the Persian period. This is the period after the Babylonian exile. The Judeans were exiled from 586 to 532. The Persians allowed them to return back and gave them a good degree of religious autonomy to worship the Lord alone. But there was also economic stratification during this period. You had those who were close to the Persian Empire, those with a great deal of power, and then you had most of the population that was poor. So this is what's happening in Nehemiah 5. There was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish kin. There were those who said, "With our sons and daughters, we are many. We must get grain so we may eat and stay alive." There are also those who said, "We are having to pledge our fields, our vineyards, and our houses in order to get grain during the famine." There are those who said, "We are having to borrow money on our fields and vineyards to pay the king's tax. Our flesh is the same as that of our kindred. Our children is the same as their children, yet we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves. Some of our daughters have been ravished. We are powerless. Fields and vineyards now belong to others." Nehemiah speaking, "I was very angry when I heard their cry and their complaints. After thinking it over, I brought charges against the nobles, and I said to them, 'You're taking interest from your own people.' I called a great assembly." He called a meeting. "As far as we're able, we've brought back to our Jewish kindred who've been sold to other nations. They're upset." He says, "Restore to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, their houses, the interest on money, grain, and wild that you've been exacting from them." And then a few verses later, Nehemiah says, "I'm going to give everybody a tax break this year since these lenders have been such jerks." This is a very specific crisis. And note here that what seems to lie in the background is this law in Deuteronomy that the Jews in the time of Nehemiah are not adhering to that. And Nehemiah is saying, and the people who are being cheated are saying, "You're taking advantage of fellow Judeans. You're taking advantage of fellow believers and going against what the Torah commands." So we do have in this passage what seems to be a real crisis. That relates to interest charging. What we seem to have is a class of creditors who worked with farmers, and the farmers had to speculate on the next year's produce in order to buy seed and necessary supplies, and the creditors are making a bundle, heightening their demands, increasing the rates, and all of these details would point to a pretty developed system for usury. There's other examples I could give from this same period that would seem to correlate with this. This is a really interesting example which shows, in my judgment, the timelessness of human behavior, the fact that you have these laws that aren't really being adhered to, and it shows the human capacity that even if interest makes sense in a less advanced economic system such as ancient Judea's, in order to enact transactions, and there's tons of contracts that indicate interest was very common, there's going to be a natural tendency for those in power, those with resources, to take advantage of those who do not. The corollary to this, from my perspective, would be the modern practice of payday lending, where you have, I did an experiment a few years ago when I was writing the book. I did a two-mile drive, maybe I mentioned this last week, around the seminary, found 20 payday lending facilities within a couple of miles of the seminary, where you have interest rates as much as 300% and 400%. And it's almost always the case that the person has to roll over the loan in much the same way that the poor farmers in Nehemiah had to roll over their loans and ended up losing their land. So it does, I think, speak to the somewhat timelessness of how interest can work in malicious ways as well as in healthy ways in any economic system. So maybe I'll stop for a minute there. I'm going to cover some other stuff, but as long as we're talking about interest specifically, does anybody have any questions or clarifications on those passages? Yes.
To the extent that interest itself was condemned, does the scripture ever explain what's wrong with interest?
I don't think interest is ever condemned as intrinsically evil. It's not, because Even in the Exodus passage, in the Leviticus passage, Deuteronomy is a bit more comprehensive. But most of the biblical laws, most of the biblical passages would allow that interest charging is necessary in order to enact a loan. This goes all the way back to the Code of Hammurabi. What the biblical laws are acknowledging, and they're doing it more than the other ancient law codes do, what they're acknowledging is the human propensity for greed and the vulnerability of the poor in the social structure in which interest occurs in particularly egregious ways. That's what the concern is. That's what's at stake in Nehemiah. And as we can see today, there is a reluctance to regulate to the extent that it is controlled in a way that protects the poor. Every time there's an effort, there have been some states, Virginia is lagging behind other states, for example, in regulating payday lending. So it's more about the vulnerability of the poor more than anything else. Now, help me out here in the Baptist tradition. What do you say? Do you use trespasses or debts in the Lord's Prayer?
Trespasses.
If I were king, we would all say debts. Matthew 6:12 is Matthew's version of it. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. The Lucan version has sins instead of debts. But I think the economic vocabulary in Matthew is significant. The prayer implies that human indebtedness to God requires a plea for forgiveness. But this plea, this is what I was talking about with the theology of obligation. Just as we're indebted to God, we should forgive those who are indebted to us. And I think that can be a very concrete prayer that Jesus intended in Matthew. That to forgive one's debts is to have a spirit of generosity when it comes to financial and material matters. And Matthew, Jesus in Matthew is very specific about these kinds of things. So there is a philanthropic spirit of the prayer there that also plays out in the other parables. So, but I don't know that I'm going to have any success in getting everybody to say debts, but even the Presbyterian Church is gravitating away from it. But don't forget that's Matthew's version of the prayer. And he's speaking of the laws like the ones we've just been looking at. That's what he has in mind. All right. Let's move to being a guarantor, or the technical term for it is standing surety, being a vouching for someone else's loan. Let me ask a question. Is there anybody in here, you can raise your hand or silently nod if you don't want to raise your hand. Have you ever gone in on a financial transaction? Have you ever co-signed a loan with someone who was a buddy one of the things that we've done a couple times in my family, have you ever gone in with somebody on a boat and then regretted it very much a few years later? There is a sense, or have you signed a lease for somebody, maybe an offspring, and that led to issues down the line, even if it was a very loved one of yours? I mean, that's a complicated thing to do, to vouch for someone else's loan, or to get into a business transaction with somebody. The Bible is surprisingly commonsensical about this. Yes, there's a spirit of generosity and giving that is required, but there's also a practicality that is there. Don't be one of those who gives pledges, who becomes surety for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should your bed be taken out from under you? This is from the book of Proverbs, which gives very practical advice. Don't have your bed. Now, hang on a second. Who gives pledges. It's almost, they would, in not every case would they have signed a contract, but the word for giving pledges there would be almost like if Scott and I were going to enact a loan, we would give each other a high five. That's what the Hebrew said. Don't pledge yourself to somebody. It really literally says don't give somebody a high five and then go in, I'm now beholden to Scott for the loan that he just gave me. Or he and I, he said, I need some help to build this farmhouse. We're going to go borrow from that guy. Will you pledge with me? Proverbs is saying be darn careful about that because you don't want to have, I don't want if Scott can't pay, I don't want to be on the hook and then be in trouble. That's the lot. Here's another longer version of this. My son, if you've given surety to your neighbor and made an agreement, clasped hands for a stranger, if you have snared yourself by the utterance of your lips, captured yourself by the words of your mouth, do this therefore, my son, and rescue yourself. You've come into the power of your neighbor. Go grovel and implore your neighbor. Don't let your eyes have sleep, your eyelids have rest. Rescue yourself like a gazelle from a hunter's hand, like a bird from a fowler's hand. There's a sense here, there's sort of a real urgency about not being a guarantor. The lender can seize everything down to your cloak, can take everything back if someone is not able to pay. So you have to be very careful in those instances. Let's see. And it doesn't mean that we have neighbor. Your neighbor could be someone you kind of know. It doesn't necessarily have to be your closest friend, but it is someone who you know who's asking you to go in on a loan together. The concern with financial ruin is not surprising in Proverbs, because Proverbs is a book that really thinks about common sense advice, as I've mentioned. There is a sense here in which it is a bit odd, slightly odd, in the Bible, which is always encouraging us to be kind to our neighbors, to love our neighbor, to do what we should. So there's a bit of an oddity about this. I think it just proves that Scripture is often complex, and sometimes common sense is cited. Here's another passage. This is in the Apocrypha, but it's interesting. A good person will be surety for his neighbor. The one who has lost all sense of shame will fail him. Don't forget the kindness of your guarantor. He's given his life for you. A sinner wastes the property of the guarantor. The sinner comes to grief through surety. His pursuit of gain involves him in lawsuits. Assist your neighbor to the best of your ability, but be careful not to fall yourself. In other words, do as much as you can, but check your bank statement before you sign, is what it's saying. Like, try to be generous, but don't go overboard. I just think this whole line of thought is really interesting, in the sense that it encourages caution, and it encourages one to be careful when one vouches for a loan, because sometimes it can end up very badly. Any comments or questions on that? You know, when we think of Jesus, you know, commandments to give away everything you have and to, take up and follow me, this is a bit of a striking, somewhat difference from those passages, which I have always found interesting. But here it is in the Bible, in Proverbs and elsewhere. All right. The last thing I want to talk about, we'll spend a little more time on this, is bribery. It seems very clear that bribery played a role in the economic context of the biblical period. You see some basic prohibitions against bribes. And then in Proverbs, the statement is made, hey, a bribe can really help you. Cursed be anyone who takes a bribe to shed innocent blood. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes, blinds the officials, and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. Then a gift opens doors. It gives access to the great. All right. One question I would ask you. Is there a difference here? It seems to be there is in the ancient context. Do you see a difference? Can you tell the difference between a bribe and a gift? And what is, if so, what is that difference?
Intent.
So what would you, what is the intent of a bribe?
Something in return.
Something in return.
Quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo, there you go. Is there quid pro quo involved? That's really interesting. Okay. Let me ask this. There's a whole discussion on this among anthropologists about gift giving. And what their argument is that we live in a web of reciprocity. and that even gift giving expects something in return. That if I give my wife a birthday present, as I did last month, I'm doing so, and I could say, I'm just doing it because I love her dearly. I don't want her to get anything on my birthday, but that's not true. I do want her to get me something on my birthday. I do want it. So there is a sense in which there is what I call a web of reciprocity that would anticipate, yes, we do expect something in return. Let me ask you this. And I know there's anonymous gift giving and whatnot, but have you ever seen or yourself waited until the person at Starbucks or wherever you are is facing you for when you put the dollar in the tip jar? Or do you do it when he or she is turned around? I would venture to say that there's been times, it's true for me, that I've done it. I've done it when I know the person. I don't like go like this, hey. But I make it a point to do it when they're facing me and not turning around and making my chai tea.
If you use change, it clinks.
If you just change, it clinks. But then they may look around and go, you're being cheap. So that's also possible. But in other words, I would say, you know, there's not anything wrong with that necessarily. One anthropologist has said there's no such thing really in most societies of what he would call what he referred to as a pure gift. That everything we do for somebody else usually is with, even our charitable contributions, we hope will provide us some benefit or other. It's not to say we don't do it out of a spirit of generosity, but maybe there is some expectation of something in return. So if this is me stirring the pot. So how would you then describe the difference between a gift and a bribe? Or would you make a distinction?
There's a degree to which it becomes inappropriate. Okay, let me give you an example. When I was a young school administrator, I was cautioned that if a vendor, let's say a furniture vendor that wants a big contract for a new school or something, wants to take you to dinner, you cannot accept a dinner of more than $50.
Right.
You know, that'd be like reasonable transaction, but any more than that is a bribe, and you certainly don't let them promise you a big oak desk for the principal's office
right. If
you do business with them.
I think that's exactly right. And I think each field has its own idiosyncrasies with this regard. Let me give you an anecdote. So I think there's a sense in which, and there's efforts to regulate this, although there's subjectivity, a bribe, we tend to know a bribe when we see it because it often involves either illicit ends or exercising undue influence in a situation. But again, let me give the example of my wife, who's a primary care physician. And when she first started practicing in the 90s, we went to a couple of, we lived in Chicago, I was finishing my master's, and there's a couple of times we went out to Broadway shows in Chicago that a drug company paid for, and she said, I just don't feel right about this, and I'm not gonna do it anymore. But other physicians said it would go on trips to Colorado or Hawaii with the drug company and let them pay for the whole thing. And there was definitely, one could argue whether that's a bribe or not. The one thing, and the AMA and most states have cut down on this to the extent that you now drug companies can't even take physicians, like you can't do that anymore. You can do certain things. Helen won't go out to dinner with them, but what she will do is allow them to bring her lunch at the office, and she will eat lunch while they're talking to her about their drug. She said, if they want to come talk to me, I'll let them provide lunch. The one thing they quit doing that was somehow outlawed, which really upset me as a professor who's always needing writing instruments, she used to bring me like crates of pins. And now you can't do that anymore. I had like 5 boxes of Viagra pins. And everyone was like, why are you so into Viagra? And I said, well, you know, get them from the missus. Exactly, yeah. Y'all can go with that with what you wear. But that is, the question is where we draw the line between a gift and a bribe is a relevant one. Let me give you my definitions, both in the ancient world and in today. A bribe is the bestowal of money, goods, or personal labor solely for the purpose of influencing a favorable outcome such an act frequently occurs in secret. A gift, on the other hand, is a more acceptable act, and a gift represents the bestowal of something to be kind to someone within one's kinship group or provide economic benefit for all parties. And that's the case in the Bible as well. We are able to determine a gift seems to be more acceptable in the Bible than a bribe is. So, and yet, it is said a gift opens doors, it gives access to the great.
Sam, do you read that Proverbs verse more as a statement of fact?
Yeah, it's more of a statement of fact, yes. More of a statement of fact.
A warning about what wealthy people are able to do.
I think it's probably both. I think it is definitely a statement of fact, but it also, this is very similar. A bribe is like a magic stone in the eyes of those who give it. Wherever they turn, they prosper. Favors and gifts blind the eyes of the wise. Like a muzzle in the mouth, they stop reproofs. If you're in trouble, a bribe can sometimes help you out. And a bribe is like a magic stone in the eyes of those who give it. Wherever they turn, they prosper. So I do think in those cases it is a statement of... that's a really good question. I think it's both. It probably is a statement of what can happen, as well as maybe an implicit warning about what can happen. All right, one last passage, one of my favorites. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and violation of the right, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official or payment taker, really should be translated as payment taker, is watched by higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. What this is from the author, the author of Ecclesiastes is writing about a little bit later than Nehemiah. He's writing during the period in which the successors of Alexander the Great were there. So in the period of Hellenistic rule, influence over the Jews, and it seems to be the case that you have networks of officials, both foreign and local, who are taking advantage of the poor, and that there's a whole sort of a good old boy network with back scratching, bribery, payoffs, and the poor are vulnerable within this system. So he's saying, don't be amazed at the matter. It seems to be, to your question point, there's just saying, this is the way human beings operate. You should beware and be forewarned. So he's just saying it's sort of part of the woodwork for the context, which would continue into the period of Jesus' day. One of the interesting things about Jesus' day was it was a Roman period, and bribery and gift giving was very commonplace. Every street corner would have a building or a monument with a sign on it, with a whole bunch of donors who were prominent Roman citizens, prominent local Jews, who would put up saying, hey, I donated this particular facility, I made a donation for X, Y, or Z. So it was very much a culture of reciprocity, gift giving, and getting attention for it, which is, again, shows that there are certain timeless aspects of human behavior. All right.
You just described the modern university.
Yes, it's very similar to that. Well, the modern university is very Roman in many, it looks all the way back to the whole Roman model in many respects for its, not just its curriculum, but the way it's going to be laid out. So that's exactly what it is. You know, every building has, you know, you walk in and then there's a list of donors. And those donors wield significant power over the trusteeship of that university. And usually they wield significant power wherever they live. The same would have been true very much in Jesus' day. So you put these things together, interest, guarantor, vouching for loans, wariness about that, bribes, gifts, however you want to describe it. It shows that, I think it shows a couple things. It shows that the biblical world was complex, even if the economy was not as industrial or sophisticated as ours. It was very complex. It was one in which the poor were vulnerable. And also, I think it shows certain timeless aspects of human behavior. And from my perspective, this is one of the reasons why the biblical texts relating to wealth and poverty, in particular some of the ones I've shown you tonight, again, have a timeless element to them. Somebody had raised the question last week, well, okay, that's true, but now what do we do with it? What do we do with that in terms of making public policy? That's a good question. But I, And I don't have a great answer for that, except I do think they provide an ethical template for us as Christians to follow. So maybe let's have, we have maybe 5-10 minutes for discussion. Does anybody have questions, comments, pushbacks? I know this was a more technical week, but hopefully you got a sense of some of the more specific laws related to financial transactions.
What are some of the limits on the payday lending, the interest rates?
You mean today?
Yeah.
Not much. I don't know how much it's being regulated in Virginia. Most people do will go initially. I don't know what your first. There's a max on what your first loan can be. But if you can't pay back the first time, then it happens that you would then go get a rollover loan. And I do know. I've studied it enough to know that most borrowers roll over at least 4 times before. The scenario, say somebody's having trouble getting to or from work and needs to make a $300 repair on her car. So she goes and borrows it off the next paycheck, but then can't pay it back. Most likely she's going to end up paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,000 to $1,200 on the original loan. Or losing the car to the repo person. To that point, you know, that's why I want to go back to my first slide. There's a sense in which if you take your neighbor's cloak and pawn, you shall restore it before the sun goes down. Maybe your neighbor's only clothing to use as cover. What else shall that person sleep? There's a sense in which interest on the backs of the poor that is particularly usurious. Remember I said the Hebrew word for interest there is the bite of a snake. Interest that is particularly serpentine in its aims is goes against what the original biblical laws are arguing. Yes?
To that point, advocacy on a national and state level, and that's one of the major emphases of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship and their social justice initiatives. So you can go home and Google that and look up the internet and see some marvelous articles. Stephen Reeves is the person at CBF headquarters who heads up that part of Cooperative Baptist Fellowship work. Did some amazing work over the course of the last decade. There were some advancements that were set to take place with the federal commission that regulates payday lending. There was some tightening of the regulations on that, and those did not come to pass. Those ended a few years back, and so that's anyway, sort of sad there. But that work is ongoing, and you can read a lot about what some of the advocacy efforts in that field.
And just to come back to your question, there is a, sort of putting those two together, there is, one of the things we find in the Bible that is refreshing and also realistic is, there is an acknowledgement in both Testaments that interest charging is going to occur and that it can be useful in an economic system. There is that passage in Deuteronomy, but there's really not there's no absolute ban or prohibition. In order for loans to be tendered, if there's no interest, I don't see how it can work. But the other thing I would say, there's also a refreshing realism, as we saw with the language about bribes, about vouching for the loan of another, is that financial transactions can be messy. You have to be very careful. And then, finally, of course, the poor are the most vulnerable in that messiness. Yes, Scott?
I was struck last week by how seamless the attitudes of the Old and the New Testament were on the subject of taking care of the poor and generosity. I didn't see anything from the New Testament tonight.
Oh, yeah. The only thing I really mentioned was I could have mentioned the parable of the tenants would have been a good one to mention. The best example, like I said, would be... to me, the best example of the New Testament for this same spirit would be Matthew's version of the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. I'm going to talk next week. I mean, you could turn to, And my favorite story in this regard is the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16. Luke is probably more than any other of the gospel writers emphatic on this emphasis on a spirit of generosity. But the story of rich man and Lazarus doesn't relate so much to generosity as it does to sort of looking down your nose at the poor. I do think the language of as we forgive our debtors is in the same spirit as the interest laws in the Torah. So yeah, and I think they are consistent on this matter as well. Yes. No, go ahead.
I know this is going to sound like preaching, but I want to get back to bribery.
Okay.
And suggest that you minimized it a little bit too much by asking what's the difference between bribes and gifts. The fact of the matter is we talk about corruption around the world. And corruption is just another word for bribery.
I agree.
I learned years ago when I was in graduate school and went to a South American country, the first thing that my friends told me there was, you've got to look out for the police or whomever, public officials of one sort or another. They are going to want a bribe. I heard on the television just this week about the fact that the one thing that distinguishes American diplomats from the diplomats of most other countries is that they refuse to take bribes.
Yeah.
So I think we Americans need to appreciate the extent to which we are not anywhere near completely free of corruption, but certainly much less so than other countries, and we ought to work hard at trying not to descend into that.
Yes, I agree.
That kind of culture.
Absolutely. Well stated. In some of those contexts, bribery is so built into the culture, it's really factored into what things cost as well.
Yeah.
I lived in India for 2 years, and I happened to find myself at a bank one Friday afternoon, and there was just a series of people coming in and out with suitcases full of money, and I finally went over and asked the bank guy who I knew. He said, "What are they doing?" And he goes, he sort of winked, he goes, "Weekly payouts." That was just part of the system, but built into the way things were. You're absolutely right. Yeah, thank you for making that point. Yeah.
How would you rate something like people give to public radio, and they want nothing in return, but they do want the acknowledgement that they have done something?
Right.
No matter how much. That's not a bribe.
No, I don't think so either. I guess what I was arguing, no, I would consider that to be a generous gift. I guess what I was trying to make a bit more complex and ask the question is, how much of the gifts we give in a particular context are what anthropologists call pure gifts, where we don't expect anything in return? If you give to public radio, several things I would hope would come out of that. One is you want to support it because you want it to thrive. You want to be able to avail yourself of it. You want to be able to listen to it. There's nothing wrong with that. But you do have an interest in that. You're contributing to a system in which you think public radio is an essential part of it. You may also be someone, I don't know if you are, who would like your name in the list of contributors to show that you were generous.
Well, suppose you give to the Red Cross.
Right.
You know what I know who you are.
That's true. But again, I mean, this is, I don't mean this to sound cynical. Because I think it's wonderful. It's generous and all those things, especially when people do so in the midst of a natural disaster. They're doing it out of a genuine feeling of compassion and whatnot. But at the same time, there is a system in place that benefits you. You can then, when tax season rolls around, take that as a tax write-off. So there's a sense in which you will benefit in some way. So in that sense, even that is not a pure gift. So You know, and that's, that comes closer to a pure gift, I would argue, than giving my wife a birthday present, giving to the Red Cross. Because when I do that, I'm again, her, you know, my, her birthday was last month, mine was last week. And so I always know, hey, a month rolls around, I'm going to get something. So, but a very, very good question. Do we have to stop? Probably so. Maybe one more question or we can be done.
You know, at the end of the year, come October, the big thing that you read in the newspaper and on the TV and everything is it's tax time.
Yeah.
Make your contributions now to get your tax right off.
There's a reason.
I mean, every church does it. Every organization does it.
Yeah.
Is that a gift?
Well, I mean, again, it's, I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, it is a gift. But it's not, I mean, I guess I would argue there's nothing wrong with that.
It's a gift with a benefit.
Yeah, it's a gift with a benefit. And so what's the, I mean, you know, what's wrong with giving a gift that, I don't see anything wrong with it. I guess I'm just pointing out that it is still part of a, yeah, of a, you know, my web of reciprocity notion, that it is still part, you're still getting something out of it slightly,
yeah,
even if it's a later tax write-off. But yeah, good nonprofits are going to appeal to that, to sort of say, hey, get your gift in before December the 31st, so that, you know, and if some of you are like me, you think, well, if I do this check on December the 20th, I can take the tax write-off this year rather than writing the check on December the 5th. I have friends who work at nonprofits who tell me, I get some checks on January the 7th that are backdated December the 30th a lot. So, you know, there is that piece of it as well. So anyway, one last question.
I just like the commercial from recent, as an insurance company and as a grandfather, and he can save all his life for his green car, and he sees his granddaughter, and he gives her the keys. He says, and they, well, that was your green car. I said, this is my green car. Anyway,
yeah.
That should be his insurance.
I think so. Yeah. I'm not saying it never happens. It certainly does. Absolutely. I mean, that kind of thing, especially, yeah, I mean, a grandparent's gift to a grandchild comes pretty darn close. Yeah, I would agree. So I would definitely agree. All right, well, thanks for a good discussion. Next week, we'll have one more session. And we're going to talk about sort of the economic vision in Scripture and how we translate it today, particularly in relation to generosity and justice.